across the Vin River, while downstream, a series of shallow draft cable barges took advantage of the deeper water to transport an endless shuttling of goods across the river. This was where Tilth met Pharaoh in trade, where orchards and fields and cattle came together, and where goods shipped upriver from Buck or Bairns or the far lands beyond were unloaded at last and sent on their way to the nobles who could afford them. To Tradeford, in better days, had come the trade goods of the Mountain Kingdom and the lands beyond, amber, rich furs, carved ivory, and the rare incense barks of the rain wilds. Here, too, was flax, brought to be manufactured into fine farrow linen, and hemp, worked into fiber for rope and sailcloth. I was offered a few hours' work, unloading grain sacks from a small barge to a wagon. I took it, more for the conversation than the coppers. I learned little. No one spoke of red ships or the war being fought along the coast, other than to complain of the poor quality of goods that came from the coast, and how much was charged for the little that was sent. Little was said of King Regal, and what few words I did hear took pride in his ability to attract women and to drink well. I was startled to hear him spoken of as a Mountwell king, the name of his mother's royal line. Then I decided it suited me just as well that he did not name himself a farseer. It was one less thing I had to share with him. I heard much of the king's circle, however, and what I heard soured my guts. The concept of a duel to defend the truth of one's words was an old one in the Six Duchies. At Buckkeep, there were the great standing pillars in the witness stones. It is said that when two men meet there to resolve a question with their fists, El and Ida themselves witness it and see that justice does not go awry. The stones and the custom are very ancient. When we spoke of the king's justice at Buckkeep, often enough it referred to the quiet work that Chade and I did for King Shrewd. Some came to make public petition to King Shrewd himself, and to abide by whatever he might see as right. But there were times when other injustices came to be known of by the king, and then he might send forth Chade or me to work his will quietly upon the wrongdoer. In the name of the king's justice, I had meted out fates both mercifully swift and punitively slow. I should have been hardened to death. But Regal's king's circle had more of entertainment than justice to it. The premise was simple. Those judged by the king as deserving of punishment or death were sent to his circle. There they might face animals, starved and taunted to madness, or a fighter, a king's champion. Some occasional criminal who put up a very good show might be granted royal clemency, or even become a champion for the king. Forged ones had no such chance. Forged ones were put out for the beasts to maul, or starved and turned loose on other offenders. Such trials had become quite popular of late, so popular that the crowds were outgrowing the market circle at Tradeford, where their justice was currently administered. Now, Regal was having a special circle built. It would be conveniently closer to his manor house, with holding cells and secure walls that would confine both beasts and prisoners more strongly, with seats for those who came to observe the spectacle of the king's justice being meted out. The construction of the king's circle was providing new commerce and jobs for the city of Tradeford. All welcomed it as a very good idea in the wake of the shutdown of trade with the Mountain Kingdom. I heard not one word spoken against it. When the wagon was loaded, I took my pay and followed the other stevedores to the nearby tavern. Here, in addition to ale and beer, one could buy a handful of herbs and a smoke censer for the table. The atmosphere inside the tavern was heavy with the fumes, and my eyes soon felt gummy and my throat raw from it. No one else seemed to pay it any mind or even to be greatly affected by it. The use of burning herbs as an intoxicant had never been common at Buckkeep, and I had never developed a head for it. My coins brought me a serving of meal pudding with honey, and a mug of very bitter beer that tasted to me of river water. I asked several folk if it was true that they were hiring stable hands for the king's own stable, and if so, where a man might go to ask for the work. That one such as I might seek to work for the king himself afforded most of them some amusement, but as I had affected to be slightly simple the whole time I was working with them, I was able to accept their rough humour and suggestions with a bland smile. One rake at last told me that I should go to ask the king himself, and gave me directions to Tradeford Hall. I thanked him, and drank off the last of my beer, and set out. I suppose I had expected some stone edifice with walls and fortifications. This was what I watched for as I followed my directions inland and up away from the river. Instead, I eventually reached a low hill, if one could give that name to so modest an upswelling. The extra height was enough to afford a clear view of the river in both directions, and the fine stone structures upon it had taken every advantage of it. I stood on the busy road below, all but gawking up at it. It had none of Buckkeep's forbidding martial aspects. Instead, the white pebbled drive and gardens and trees surrounded a dwelling at once palatial and welcoming. Tradeford Hall and its surrounding buildings had never seen use as fortress or keep. It had been built as an elegant and expensive residence. Patterns had been worked into the stone walls, and there were graceful arches to entryways. Towers there were, but there were no arrow slits in them. One knew they had been constructed to afford the dweller a wider view of his surroundings, more for pleasure than for any wariness. There were walls, too, between the busy public road and the mansion, but they were low, fat stone walls, mossy or ivied, with nooks and crannies where statues were framed by flowering vines. One broad carriageway led straight up to the great house. Other, narrower walks and drives invited one to investigate lily ponds and cleverly pruned fruit trees, or quiet, shady walks. For some visionary gardener had planted here oaks and willows at least 100 years ago, and now they towered and shaded and whispered in the wind off the river. All of this beauty was spread over more acreage than a good-sized farm. I tried to imagine a ruler who had both the time and resources to create all this. Was this what one could have if one did not need warships and standing armies? Had Patience ever known this sort of beauty in her parents' home? Was this what the fool echoed in his delicate vases of flowers and bowls of silver fish in his room? I felt grubby and uncouth, and it was not because of my clothes. This, indeed, I suddenly felt, was how a king should live, amid art and music and graciousness, elevating the lives of his people by providing a place for such things to flourish. I glimpsed my own ignorance, and worse, the ugliness of a man trained only to kill others. I felt sudden anger, too, at all I had never been taught, never even glimpsed. Had not Regal and his mother had a hand in that as well, in keeping the bastard in his place? I had been honed as an ugly, functional tool, just as craggy, barren Buckkeep was a fort, not a palace. But how much beauty would survive here did not Buckkeep stand like a snarling dog at the mouth of the Buck River? It was like a dash of cold water in my face, it was true. Was not that why Buckkeep had been built in the first place, to gain control of the river trade? If Buckkeep ever fell to the raiders, these broad rivers would become high roads for their shallow draft vessels. They would plunge like a dagger into this soft underbelly of the six duchies. These indolent nobles and cocky farm lads would waken to screams and smoke in the night, with no castle to run to, no guards to stand and fight for them. Before they died, they might come to know what others had endured to keep them safe. Before they died, they might rail against a king who had fled those ramparts to come inland and hide himself in pleasures. But I intended that king would die first. I began a careful walk of the perimeter of Tradeford Keep. The easiest way in must be weighed against the least noticed one, and the best ways out must be planned as well. Before nightfall, I would find out all I could about Tradeford Hall. 9. Assassin. The last true skillmaster to preside over royal pupils at Buckkeep was not Galen, as is often recorded, but his predecessor, Solicity. She had waited, perhaps over long, to select an apprentice. When she chose Galen, she had already developed the cough that was to end her life. Some say she took him on in desperation, knowing she was dying. Others, that he was forced on her by Queen Desire's wish to see her favorite advanced at court. Whatever the case, he had been her apprentice for scarcely 2 years before Solicity succumbed to her cough and died. As previous skillmasters had served apprenticeships as long as 7 years before achieving journey status, it was rather precipitate that he declared himself skillmaster immediately following Solicity's death. It scarcely seems possible that she could have imparted her full knowledge of the skill and all its possibilities in such a brief time. No one challenged his claim, however. Although he had been assisting Solicity in the training of the two princes, Verity and Chivalry, he pronounced their training complete following Solicity's death. Thereafter, he registered suggestions that he train any others until the years of the Red Ship Wars, when he finally gave in to King Shrewd's demand and produced his first and only coterie. Unlike traditional coteries that selected their own membership and leader, Galen created his from hand-picked students, and during his life retained a tremendous amount of control over them. August, the nominal head of the coterie, had his talent blasted from him in a skill mishap while on a mission to the Mountain Kingdom. Serene, who next assumed leadership following Galen's death, perished along with another member, Justin, during the riot that followed the discovery of King Shrewd's murder. Will was next to assume the leadership of what has come to be known as Galen's coterie. At that time, but 3 members remained: Will himself, Burl, and Carad. It seems likely that Galen had imprinted all 3 with an unswerving loyalty to Regal, but this did not prevent rivalry among them for Regal's favor. By the time dusk fell, I had explored the outer grounds of the royal estate rather thoroughly. I had discovered that anyone might stroll the lower walks freely, enjoying the fountains and gardens, the yew hedges and the chestnut trees, and there were a number of folk in fine clothes doing just that. Most looked at me with stern disapproval, a few with pity, and the one liveried guard I encountered reminded me firmly that no begging was allowed within the king's gardens. I assured him that I had come only to see the wonders I had so often heard of in tales. In turn, he suggested that tales of the gardens were more than sufficient for my ilk, and pointed out to me the most direct path for leaving the gardens. I thanked him most humbly, and walked off. He stood watching me leave until the path carried me around the end of a hedge, and out of his sight. My next foray was more discreet. I had briefly considered waylaying one of the young nobles strolling amidst the flowers and herbaceous borders, and availing myself of his clothes, but had decided against it. I was unlikely to find one lean enough for his clothes to fit me properly, and the fashionable apparel they were wearing seemed to require a lot of lacing up with gaily colored ribbons. I doubted I could get myself into any of the shirts without the assistance of a valet, let alone get an unconscious man out of one. The tinkling silver charms stitched into the dangling lace at the cuffs were not conducive to an assassin's quiet work anyway. Instead, I relied on the thick plantings along the low walls for shelter and made my way gradually up the hill. Eventually, I encountered a wall of smooth-worked stone that encircled the crown of the hill. It was only slightly higher than a tall man could reach at a jump. I did not think it had been intended as a serious barrier. There were no plantings along it, but stubs of old trunks and roots showed that once it had been graced with vines and bushes. I wondered if Regal had ordered it cleared. Over the wall, I could see the tops of numerous trees and so dared to count on their shelter. It took me most of the afternoon to make a full circle of the wall without coming out into the open. There were several gates in it. One fine main one had guards in livery greeting carriages of folk as they came and went. From the number of carriages arriving, some sort of festivity was scheduled for the evening. One guard turned and laughed harshly. The hair stood up on my neck. For a time I stood frozen, staring from my place of concealment. Had I seen his face before? It was difficult to tell at my distance, but the thought roused a strange mixture of fear and anger in me. Regal. I reminded myself, Regal was my target. I moved on. Several lesser gates for delivery folk and servants had guards lacking in lace, but making up for it in their militant questioning of every man or woman who went in and out. If my clothes had been better, I would have risked impersonating a serving man, but I dared not attempt it in my beggar's rags. Instead, I positioned myself out of sight of the guards on the gate and began to beg of the tradefolk coming and going. I did so mutely, simply approaching them with cupped hands and a pleading expression. Most of them did what folk do when confronted with a beggar. They ignored me and continued their conversations. And so I learned that tonight was the night of the Scarlet Ball, that extra servants, musicians, and conjurers had been brought in for the festivity, that Marybud had replaced mirthweed as the king's favourite smoke, and that the king had been very angry with the quality of the yellow silk one Festro had brought him, and had threatened to flog the merchant for even bringing him such poor stuff. The ball was also a farewell to the king, before he embarked on the morrow for a trip to visit his dear friend Lady Celestra at Amber Hall on the Vin River. I heard a great deal more besides, but little that related to my purpose. I ended up with a handful of coppers for my time as well. I returned to Tradeford. I found a whole street devoted to the tailoring of clothes. At the back door of Festro's shop, I found an apprentice sweeping out. I gave him several coppers for some scraps of yellow silk in various shades. I then sought out the humblest shop on the street, where every coin I possessed was just sufficient to purchase loose trousers, a smock, and a head kerchief such as the apprentice had been wearing. I changed my clothes in the shop, braided my warrior's tail up and concealed it under the kerchief, donned my boots, and emerged from the shop a different person. My sword now hung down my leg inside the trousers. It was uncomfortable, but not overly noticeable if I affected a loping stride. I left my worn clothes and the rest of my bundle, save for my poisons and other pertinent tools, in a patch of nettles behind a very smelly backhouse in a tavern yard. I made my way back to Tradeford's keep. I did not permit myself to hesitate. I went directly to the tradefolk's gate and stood in line with the others, seeking admittance. My heart hammered inside my ribs, but I affected a calm demeanour. I spent my time studying what I could see of the house through the trees. It was immense. Earlier, I had been amazed that so much arable land had been given over to decorative gardens and walks. Now, I saw that the gardens were simply the setting for a dwelling that both sprawled and towered in a style of house completely foreign to me. Nothing about it spoke of fortress or castle. All was comfort and elegance. When it came my turn, I showed my swatches of silk and said I came bearing Festro's apologies and some samples that he hoped would be more to the king's liking. When one surly guard pointed out that Festro usually came himself, I replied, somewhat sulkily, that my master thought stripes would better become my back than his, if the samples did not please the king. The guards exchanged grins and admitted me. I hastened up the path until I was on the heels of a group of musicians who had come in before me. I followed them around to the back of the manor house. I knelt to refasten my boot as they asked directions and then straightened up just in time to follow them inside. I found myself in a small entry hall, cool and almost dark after the heat and light of the afternoon sun. I trailed them down a corridor. The minstrels talked and laughed among themselves as they hastened on. I slowed my steps and dropped back. When I passed a door that was ajar on an empty room, I stepped into it and shut the door quietly behind me. I drew a deep breath and looked around. I was in a small sitting room. The furniture was shabby and ill-matched, so I surmised it was for servants or visiting craftsmen. I could not count on being alone there for long. There were, however, several large cupboards along the wall. I chose one that was not in direct view of the door should it open suddenly, and quickly rearranged its contents in order to sit inside it. I ensconced myself, with the door slightly ajar for some light, and went to work. I inspected and organized my vials and packets of poisons. I treated both my belt knife and my sword's edge with poison, then resheathed them carefully. I arranged my sword to hang outside my trousers. Then I made myself comfortable and settled down to wait. Days seemed to pass before dusk gave way to full dark. Twice folk briefly entered the room, but from their gossip I gathered that every servant was busy preparing for the gathering tonight. I passed the time by imagining how Regal would kill me if he caught me. Several times I almost lost my courage. Each time I reminded myself that if I walked away from this, I would have to live with the fear forever. Instead, I tried to prepare myself. If Regal were here, then his coterie would surely be close by. I put myself carefully through the exercises Verity had taught me to shield my mind from the other skilled ones. I was horribly tempted to venture out with a tiny touch of the skill to see if I could sense them. I refrained. I doubted I could sense them without betraying myself. And even if I could so detect them, what would it tell me that I did not already know? Better to concentrate on guarding myself from them. I refused to allow myself to think specifically of what I would do, lest they pick up traces of my thoughts. When finally the sky outside the window was full black and pricked with stars, I slipped out from my hiding place and ventured out into the hallway. Music drifted on the night. Regal and his guests were at their festivities. I listened for a moment to the faint notes of a familiar song about two sisters, one of whom drowned the other. To me, the wonder of the song was not a harp that would play by itself, but a minstrel who would find a woman's body and be inspired to make a harp of her breastbone. Then I put it out of my mind and concentrated on business. I was in a simple corridor, stone-floored and panelled with wood, lit with torches set at wide intervals. Servants' areas, I surmised. It was not fine enough for Regal or his friends. That did not make it safe for me, however. I needed to find a servant's stair and get myself to the second floor. I crept along the hall. I went from door to door, pausing to listen outside each one. Twice I heard folk within, women talking together in one, the clack of a weaving frame being used in another. The quiet doors that were not locked, I opened briefly. They were workrooms for the most part, with several given over to weaving and sewing. In one, a suit of fine blue fabric was pieced out on a table, ready for sewing. Regal apparently still indulged his fondness for fine clothing. I came to the end of the corridor and peered around the corner. Another hallway, much finer and wider. The plastered ceiling overhead had been imprinted with fern shapes. Again I crept down a corridor, listening outside doors, cautiously peeping into some of them. Getting closer, I told myself. I found a library, with more vellum books and scrolls than I had ever known existed. I paused in one room where brightly plumed birds in extravagant cages dozed on their perches. Slabs of white marble had been set to hold ponds of darting fishes and water lilies. There were benches and cushioned chairs set about gaming tables there. Small cherrywood tables scattered about held smoke sensors. I had never even imagined such a room. I eventually came to a proper hall with framed portraits along the walls and a floor of gleaming black slate. I drew back when I spotted the guard and stood silent in an alcove until his bored pacing carried him past me. Then I slipped out to flit past all those mounted nobles and simpering ladies in their sumptuous frames. I blundered out into an antechamber. There were hangings on the wall and small tables supporting statuary and vases of flowers. Even the torch sconces here were more ornate. There were small portraits in gilt frames to either side of a fireplace, with an elaborate mantel. Chairs were set close together for intimate talk. The music was louder here, and I could hear laughter and voices as well. Despite the lateness of the hour, the merriment went on. On the opposite wall were two tall carved doors. They led to the gathering hall where Regal and his nobles danced and laughed. I pulled myself back around the corner as I saw two servants in livery enter from a door to my far left. They bore trays carrying an assortment of incense pots. I surmised they were to replace ones that had burned out. I stood frozen, listening to their footsteps and conversation. They opened the tall doors, and the music of harps spilled out more loudly, and the narcotic scent of smoke. Both were quenched by the closing doors. I ventured to peep out again. All was clear before me, but behind me.
"What do you hear?"
My heart fell into my boots. But I forced a sheepish smile to my face as I turned to face the guard who had entered the room behind me.
"Sir, I've lost my way in this great maze of a house," I said guilelessly.
"Have you? Well, that doesn't explain why you wear a sword within the king's walls. All know weapons are forbidden save to the king's own guard. I saw you sneaking about just then.
Did you think with the merrymaking going on you could just slip about and fill your pockets with whatever you found, thief?"
I stood frozen with terror, watching the man approach me. I am sure he believed he had discovered my purpose from the stricken look on my face. Verdi would never have smiled so if he thought he advanced on a man he had helped beat to death in a dungeon. His hand rested carelessly on the hilt of his own blade, and he grinned confidently. He was a handsome man, very tall and fair, as many of the Farrow folk were. The badge he wore was Mountwell of Farrow's golden oak, with the Farseer buck overleaping it. So Regal had modified his coat of arms as well. I but wished he'd left the buck off it. A part of me noticed all these things, as another part relived the nightmare of being dragged to my feet by my shirt front and stood up, so that this man could strike me and drive me once more to the floor. He was not Bolt, the one who had broken my nose. No, Verdi had followed him, beating me insensible a second time, after Bolt had left me too battered to stand on my own. He had towered over me then, and I had cowered and flinched away from him, tried vainly to scrabble away from him over the cold stone floor that was already spattered with my blood. I remembered the oaths he had laughingly uttered each time he had had to haul me to my feet so he could hit me again. "By Edith's tits," I muttered to myself, and with the words, fear died in me.
"Let's see what you have in that pouch," he demanded, and came closer.
I could not show him the poisons in my pouch, no way to explain those away. No amount of smooth lying would let me escape this man. I would have to kill him. Suddenly, it was all so simple. We were much too close to the gathering hall. I wished no sound to alarm or alert anyone. So I retreated from him, a slow step at a time, backing in a wide circle that took me into the chamber I had just left. The portraits looked down at us as I backed hesitantly away from the tall guardsman.
"Stand still!"
he ordered. But I shook my head wildly in what I hoped was a convincing display of terror.
"I said stand still, you scrawny little thief!"
I glanced quickly over my shoulder, then back at him, desperate, as if I were trying to find the courage to turn and run from him. The third time I did so, he leaped for me. I'd been hoping for that. I sidestepped him, and then drove my elbow savagely into the small of his back, adding just enough momentum to his charge that he went to his knees. I heard them smack bonily against the stone floor. He gave a wordless roar of both anger and pain. I could see how suddenly furious it made him for a scrawny thief to dare strike him. I silenced him sharply when I kicked him under the chin, clacking his mouth shut. I was grateful that I'd switched back to my boots. Before he could make another sound, I had my knife out and across his throat. He gurgled his amazement and lifted both hands in a vain attempt to contain that warm gushing of blood. I stood over him, looking down into his eyes. "Fitzchivalry," I told him quietly. "Fitzchivalry." His eyes widened in sudden understanding and terror, then lost all expression as life left him. Abruptly, he was stillness and nothingness, as devoid of life as a stone. To my wit sense, he had disappeared. So quickly it was done. Vengeance. I stood looking down at him, waiting to feel triumph or relief, or satisfaction. Instead, I felt nothing. Felt as lost to all life as he was. He was not even meat I could eat. I wondered belatedly if there was somewhere a woman who had loved this handsome man, blonde children who depended on his wages for food. It was not for an assassin to have such thoughts. They had never plagued me when I had carried out the king's justice for King Shrewd. I shook them from my head. He was making a very large puddle of blood on the floor. I had silenced him quickly, but this was just the sort of mess I hadn't wished to make. He was a large man, and it had a lot of blood in him. My mind raced as I debated whether to take time to conceal the body, or to accept that he would be quickly missed by his fellow guards and use that discovery as a diversion. In the end, I took off my shirt and sopped up as much of the blood as I could with it. Then I dumped it on his chest and wiped my bloody hands on his shirt. I seized him by the shoulders and dragged him out of the portrait hall. All the time, almost shuddering with the effort of straining my senses to be aware of anyone coming. My boots kept slipping on the polished floors, and the sound of my panting breath was a roar in my ears. Despite my efforts at mopping up the blood, we left a sheen of red on the floors behind us. At the door to the room of birds and fish, I forced myself to listen well before entering. I held my breath and tried to ignore the pounding of my heart in my ears. The room was clear of humans, however. I shouldered the door open and dragged Verdi in. Then I caught him up and tumbled him into one of the stonefish pools. The fish darted frantically as his blood trailed and swirled out into the clear water. I hastily rinsed my hands and chest clean of blood in another pond, and then left by a different door. They'd follow the blood trail here. I hoped they'd take some time puzzling as to why the killer had dragged him here and dumped him in a pond. I found myself in an unfamiliar room. I glanced quickly about at the vaulted ceiling and panelled walls. There was a grandiose chair on a dais at the far end. Some kind of an audience chamber, then. I glanced about to get my bearings, then froze where I was. The carved doors to my far right swung suddenly open. I heard laughter, a muttered question, and a giggling response. There was no time to hide and nothing to shelter behind. I flattened myself against a wall hanging and was still. The group entered on a wave of laughter. There was a note of helplessness in the laughter that told me they were either drunk or giddy with smoke. They walked right past me, two men vying for the attention of a woman who simpered and tittered behind a tasseled fan. All three of them were dressed entirely in shades of red, and one of the men had tinkling silver charms, not just at the lace of his cuffs, but all along his loose sleeves to his elbows. The other man carried a small censer of smoke on an ornamented rod, almost like a scepter. He swung it back and forth before them as they walked, so that they were always wreathed in the sweetish fumes. I doubted that they would have noticed me, even if I had leaped out before them, turning cartwheels. Regal seemed to have inherited his mother's fondness for intoxicants, and to be turning it into a court fashion. I stood motionless until they had passed. They went into the fish and bird room. I wondered if they would notice Verdi in the pond. I doubted it. I flitted to the doorway from which the courtiers had entered and slipped through it. I found myself suddenly in a great entry hall. It was floored with marble, and my mind boggled at the expense of hauling such an expanse of stone to Tradeford. The ceiling was high and plastered white, with designs of immense flowers and leaves pressed into the plaster. There were arched windows of stained glass, dark now against the night, but between them hung tapestries glowing with such rich colours as to seem windows on some other world and time. All was illuminated with ornate candelabra, hung with sparkling crystals, and suspended from gilded chains. Hundreds of candles burned in them. Statues were displayed on pedestals at intervals about the room, and from the look of them, most were of Regal's Mountwell ancestors from his mother's side. Despite the danger I was in, the grandness of the room captured me for a moment. Then I lifted my eyes and saw the wide staircase ascending. This was the main staircase, not the back servant stairs I had sought. 10 men abreast could have gone up it easily. The woodwork of the balustrades was dark and full of twirling knots, but shone with a deep lustre. A thick rug spilled down the centre of the steps like a blue cascade. The hall was empty, as was the staircase. I did not give myself time to hesitate, but slipped silently across the room and up the stairs. I was halfway up when I heard the scream. Evidently they had noticed Verdi. At the top of the first landing, I heard voices and running footsteps coming from the right. I fled to the left. I came to a door, pressed my ear against it, heard nothing, and slipped inside. All in less time than it takes to tell it. I stood in darkness, heart thundering, thanking Ida and El and any other gods that might exist, that the door had not been fastened. I stood in the darkness, my ear pressed to the thick door, trying to hear more than my own pounding heart. I heard shouts from below and boots running down the staircase. A moment or so passed, then I heard an authoritative voice shouting orders. I slipped to where the opening door would at least temporarily conceal me, and waited, breath stilled, hands trembling. Fear welled up in me like a sudden blackness, threatening to overwhelm me. I felt the floor rock under me, and I crouched down quickly to keep from falling in a faint. The world spun about me. I made myself small, hugging myself tight, and squeezing my eyes shut, as if somehow that would better conceal me. A second wave of fear washed over me. I sank the rest of the way to the floor and fell over on my side, all but whimpering. I curled in a ball, enduring a terrible squeezing pain in my chest. I was going to die. I was going to die, and I'd never see them again, not Molly, not Burridge, not my king. I should have gone to Verity. I knew that now. I should have gone to Verity. I wanted to scream and weep, for I was suddenly certain I could never escape, that I would be found and tortured. They would find me and kill me very, very slowly. I experienced an almost overwhelming drive simply to leap up and run out of the room, to draw a sword against the guards and force them to end me quickly.
Steady now. They try to trick you into betraying yourself.
Verity's skilling was finer than a cobweb. I caught my breath, but had the wisdom to keep still. After what seemed like a long time, my blind terror lifted. I took a long, shuddering breath, and seemed to come to myself again. When I heard the footsteps and voices outside the door, my fear surged up again, but I forced myself to lie still and listen.
"I was sure of it," said a man. "No, he's long gone. If they find him at all, they'll find him out on the grounds. No one could have stood up to both of us. If he was still in the house, we would have flushed him out. I tell you, there was something."
"Nothing,"
insisted the other voice with some annoyance.
"I sensed nothing."
"Check again,"
insisted the other.
"No, it's a waste of time. I think you were mistaken."
The first man's anger was becoming obvious despite their subdued voices.
"I hope I was, but I fear I am not. If I am correct, we've given Will the excuse he's been looking for."
There was anger in the second man's voice too, but also a whining self-pity.
"Looking for an excuse? Not that one. He speaks ill of us to the king at every turn. To hear him talk, you would think he was the only one who had made any sacrifices in King Regal's service. A maidservant told me yesterday that he makes no niceties at all about it any more. You, he says, are fat, and me he accuses of every weakness of the flesh a man can have. If I am not as lean as a soldier, it is because I am not a soldier. It is not my body that serves the king, but my mind. As well look to himself before he faults us, him with his one good eye."
The whine was unmistakable now. Burl, I suddenly realized, Burl was speaking to Carid.
"Well, I am satisfied that tonight at least he cannot fault us. There is nothing amiss here that I can find.
He has you jumping at shadows and seeing danger in every corner. Calm yourself.
This is a matter for the guards now, not us. They'll probably find it was done by a jealous husband of another guardsman. I've heard it said that Verdi won a battle too often at dice. Perhaps that is why he was left in the gaming room. So if you'll excuse me, I will return to the fairer company from which you distracted me."
"Go, then, if that is all you can think of,"
the whinier said sulkily. "But when you've a moment to spare, I think we might be wise to take counsel together."
After a moment, Burl added,
"I've more than half a mind to go to him right now, make it his problem.
He'd only end up looking like a fool. When you worry so much, you are but giving in to his influence. Let him mouth his warnings and dire predictions and spend every moment of his life on guard. To hear him tell it, his watchfulness is all the king needs. He seeks to instill that fear in us. Your quaking probably gives him much satisfaction.
Guard such thoughts carefully."
I heard one set of footsteps walking briskly away. The roaring in my ears softened a little after a time. I heard the other man leave, walking more ponderously and muttering to himself. When I could no longer hear his footfalls, I felt as if a great weight had been lifted off me. I swallowed dryly and debated my next move. Dim light fluttered in through tall windows. I could make out a bedstead, with the blankets turned back to expose the white linens. It was unoccupied. There was the dark shape of a wardrobe in the corner, and by the bed, a stand held a bowl and ewer. I forced myself to calmness. I took long, steadying breaths, then rose silently to my feet. I needed to find Regal's bedchamber, I reminded myself. I suspected it would be on this floor, with servants' quarters in the higher levels of the house. Stealth had got me this far, but perhaps now it was time to be bolder. I crossed to the wardrobe in the corner and opened it quietly. Luck had favored me again. This was a man's chamber. I went through the garments by touch, feeling for a fabric that felt serviceable.
I had to work hastily, for I assumed the rightful owner was at the festivities below and might return at any time. I found a light-coloured shirt, much more fussy about the sleeves and collar than I could wish, but almost long enough in the arms. I managed to get into it, and a darker-coloured pair of leggings that felt too loose on me. I belted them up, and hoped they did not hang too strangely. There was a pot of scented pomade. I finger-brushed my hair back from my face with it, and secured it afresh in a tail, discarding the tradesman's kerchief. Most of the courtiers I had seen earlier wore theirs in oiled curls, much as Regal did, but a few of the younger ones kept their hair tied back. I felt about in several drawers. I found some sort of medallion on a chain and put it on. There was a ring, too large for my finger, but that scarcely mattered. I would pass a casual glance, and hoped to attract no more than that. They would be looking for a shirtless man in coarse trousers to match the bloodied shirt I had left. I dared to hope they would be seeking him outside. At the threshold I paused, took a deep breath, and then slowly opened the door. The hall was empty, and I slipped out. Once out in the light, I was not pleased to find the leggings were a dark green and the shirt a buttery yellow. It was no more garish than what I had seen folk wearing earlier, though I could scarcely blend with the guests at this scarlet ball. I resolutely set the worry aside and struck off down the hall, walking casually yet purposefully, to seek for a door that was larger and more ornate than the others. I blandly tried the first one I came to, and found it unlocked. I entered, only to find myself in a room with an immense harp and several other musical instruments set out as if awaiting minstrels. A variety of cushioned chairs and couches filled the rest of the room. The paintings were all of songbirds. I shook my head, baffled at the endless riches of this one house. I continued my search. My nervousness made the hall stretch out endlessly before me. I forced myself to walk in an unhurried and confident manner. I passed door after door, cautiously sampling a few. Those on my left seemed to be bedchambers, while those on my right were larger rooms, libraries and dining rooms and the like. Instead of wall sconces, the hall was lit with shielded candles. The wall hangings were richly coloured, and at intervals, niches held vases of flowers or small statuary. I could not help but contrast it to the stark stone walls of Buckkeep. I wondered how many warships would have been built and manned with the coin that instead went to ornament this finely feathered nest. My anger fed my competence. I would find Regal's chamber. I passed three more doors, then came to one that looked promising. It was a double door of golden oak, and the oak tree that was the symbol of Pharaoh was inlaid upon it. I set my ear briefly to the door and heard nothing. Cautiously, I tried the burnished handle. The door was latched. My sheath knife was a crude tool for this type of work. Sweat soaked the yellow shirt to my back before the catch yielded to my efforts. I eased the door open and slipped inside, quickly locking it behind me. This was certainly Regal's chamber, not his bedchamber, no, but his nonetheless. I went through it swiftly. There were no less than four tall wardrobes, two on each side wall with a tall looking-glass between each set. The ornately carved door of one wardrobe was ajar, or possibly the press of the clothing from within would not allow it to be fully closed. Other garments hung on hooks and racks about the room, or were draped on chairs. A set of locked drawers in a small chest probably held jewellery. The looking-glass between the wardrobes was framed by two branches of candles, now burned low in their holders. Two small censers of smoke were set to either side of one chair that faced yet another mirror. Behind and to one side of the chair, a table held brushes, combs, pots of pomade, and vials of perfume. A narrow twining of grey fumes still rose from one of the censers. I wrinkled my nose against the sweet odour of it, and went to work. Fitz, What do you do? The faintest query from Verity. Justice.
I put no more than a breath of skill into the thought. I was not sure if it was my own or Verity's apprehension that I suddenly felt. I brushed it aside and turned to my task. It was frustrating. There was little here that was a sure vehicle for my poisons. I could treat the pomade, but I was more likely to kill whoever dressed his hair for him than Regal. The censers held mostly ash. Anything I placed there would probably be dumped with the ash. The corner hearth was swept clean for the summer, and there was no supply of wood. Patience, I told myself. His bedchamber could not be far, and opportunities would be better there. For now, I treated the bristles of his hairbrush with one of my more potent concoctions, and used what was left to dip as many of his earrings as I could. The last drops I added to his vials of scent, but with small hope that he would apply enough to kill himself. For the scented handkerchiefs folded in his drawer, I had the white spore of the death angel mushroom to beguile his hours until death, with hallucinations. I took greater pleasure in dusting the insides of four sets of gloves with dead root powder. This was the poison Regal had used on me in the mountains, and the most likely source of the seizures that had plagued me intermittently since then. I had hoped he would find his own falling fits as amusing as he had mine. I selected three of his shirts that I thought he would favor, and treated their collars and cuffs as well. There was no wood in the hearth, but I had a poison that blended well with the traces of ash and soot left on the brick. I sprinkled it generously, and hoped that when they set a fire upon it, the burning fumes might reach Regal's nose. I had just returned my poison to my pouch, when I heard a key turn the door latch. I stepped silently around the corner of a wardrobe and stood there. My knife was already in my hand, waiting. A deadly calm had settled on me. I breathed silently, waiting, hoping fortune had brought Regal to me. Instead, it was another guardsman in Regal's colors. The man pushed into the room and cast a quick glance about. His irritation showed in his face as he impatiently said, "It was locked. There's no one in here." I waited for his partner to reply, but he was alone. He stood still a moment, then sighed and walked over to the open wardrobe. "Foolishness. I'm wasting time up here while he's going to get away," he muttered to himself. But he drew his sword and carefully prodded about the interior behind the clothes. As he leaned to reach deeper into the wardrobe's interior, I caught a glimpse of his face in the mirror opposite me. My guts turned to water, and then hatred blazed up in me. I had no name for this one, but his mocking face had been forever etched into my memory. He had been part of Regal's personal guard, and had stood by to witness my death. I think he saw my reflection at the same time I saw his. I did not give him time to react, but sprang on him from behind. The blade of his sword was still tangled inside Regal's wardrobe when my knife punched low into his belly. I clamped my forearm across his throat to give me leverage as I dragged up on the knife, gutting him like a fish. His mouth gaped open to scream, and I let go my knife to slap my hand over his mouth. I held him a moment as his entrails bulged out of the gash I'd made. When I let him go, he went down. His unvoiced bellow turned to a groan. He'd not let go of his sword, so I stamped on his hand, breaking his fingers around its hilt. He rolled slightly to one side to stare up at me in agony and shock. I went down on one knee beside him, putting my face close to his. "Fitzchivalry," I said quietly, meeting his eyes, making sure he knew. Fitzchivalry. For the second time that night, I cut a throat. It scarcely needed doing. I wiped my knife on his sleeve as he died. As I stood, I felt two things. disappointment that he had died so swiftly, and a sensation as if a harp string had been plucked, letting out a sound I felt rather than heard. In the next instant, I felt a wave of skill inundate me. It was laden with terror, but this time I recognized it for what it was and knew its source. I stood firm before it, my defenses strong. I almost felt it part and go around me. Yet I sensed that even that act was read by someone, somewhere. I did not wonder who. Will felt the shape of my resistance. I felt the echo of his surge of triumph. For a moment it froze me with panic. Then I was moving, sheathing my knife, rising to slip out the door and into the still empty hallway. I had but a short time to find a new hiding place. Will had been riding with the guardsman's mind, had seen that chamber and me just as clearly as the dying man had. Like the sounding of horns, I could sense him skilling out, setting the guards into motion as if he were setting dogs to a fox's trail. As I fled, a part of me knew with undeniable certainty that I was dead. I might be able to hide myself for a time, but Will knew I was within the mansion. All he had to do was block off every exit and begin a systematic search. I raced down a hall, turned a corner, and went up a staircase there. I held my skill walls firm and clutched my tiny plan to myself as if it were a precious gem. I would find Regal's chambers and poison everything there, then I would go seeking Regal himself. If the guards discovered me first, well, I'd lead them a merry chase. They couldn't kill me. Not with all the poison I was carrying. I'd take my own life first. It wasn't much of a plan, but the only alternative was surrendering. So I raced on, past more doors, more statuary and flowers, more hangings. Every door I tried was locked. I turned another corner and was suddenly back at the top of the staircase. I felt a moment of dizzy disorientation. I attempted to brush it off, but panic rose like a black tide inside me. It appeared to be the same staircase. I knew I had not turned enough corners to have come back to it. I hurried past the staircase, past the doors again, hearing the shouts of guardsmen below me as knowledge grew and squirmed queasily inside me. Will leaned on my mind. Dizziness and pressure inside my eyes. Grimly, I set my mental walls yet again. I turned my head quickly, and my vision doubled for a moment. Smoke, I wondered. I had no head for any of the fume intoxicants that Regal favored, yet this felt like more to me than the giddiness of smoke or the mellowness of Marybud. The skill is a powerful tool in the hand of a master. I had been with Verity when he had used it against the Red Ships, to so muddle a helmsman that he turned his own ships onto the rocks, to convince a navigator that he had not yet passed a point of land when it was far behind him, to raise fears and doubts in a captain's heart before he went into battle, or to bolster the courage of a ship's crew so that they foolhardily set sail into the very teeth of a storm. How long had Will been working on me? Had he lured me here for this encounter by subtly convincing me that he would never expect me to come? I forced myself to halt at the next door. I held myself firm, focused myself on the latch of the door as I worked it. It was not locked. I slipped into it, closing the door behind me. Blue fabric was set out on a table before me, ready for sewing. I'd been in this room before. I knew a moment of relief, then checked it. No. This room had been on the ground floor. I was upstairs, wasn't I? I crossed quickly to the window, stood to one side of it, as I peered out. Far below me were the torch-lit grounds of the King's Gardens. I could see the white of the great drive gleaming in the night. Carriages were coming up it, and liveried servants darted here and there, opening doors. Ladies and gentlemen in extravagant red evening clothes were leaving in droves. I gathered that Verdi's End had rather spoiled Regal's ball. There were liveried guards on the doors, regulating who might leave and who must wait. All this I took in at a glance, and realized also that I was up a lot higher than I thought.
Yet I had been sure that this table and the blue garments waiting to be sewn had been down in the servants' wing, on the ground floor. Well, it was not all that unlikely that Regal would be having two different sets of blue clothes sewn. No time to puzzle about it. I had to find his bedchamber. I felt a strange elation as I slipped out of the room and fled once more down the hallway, a thrill not unlike that of a good hunt. Let them catch me if they could. I came suddenly to a T in the corridor, and stood a moment, puzzled. It did not seem to fit in with what I had seen of the building from outside. I glanced left, then right. Right was noticeably grander, and the tall double doors at the end of the hall were emblazoned with the golden oak of Pharaoh. As if to put spurs to me, I heard a mutter of angry voices from a room somewhere off to my left. I went right, drawing my knife as I ran. When I came to the great double doors, I put my hand to the latch quietly, expecting to find it locked tight. Instead, the door gave easily and swung forward silently. It was almost too easy. I set those apprehensions aside and slipped in, knife drawn. The room before me was dark, save for two candles burning in silver holders on the mantelpiece. I slipped inside what was obviously Regal's sitting room. A second door stood ajar, revealing the corner of a magnificently curtained bed, and beyond it, a hearth with a rack of firewood laid ready in it. I pulled the door gently closed behind me, and advanced into the room. On a low table, a carafe of wine and two glasses awaited Regal's return, as did a platter of sweets. The censer beside it was heaped with powdered smoke, waiting to be ignited on his return. It was an assassin's fantasy. I could scarcely decide where to begin. That, you see, is how it is done. I spun about, then experienced a distortion of my senses that dizzied me. I stood in the middle of a well-lit but rather bare room. Will sat, negligently relaxed, on a cushioned chair. A glass of wine waited on a table beside him. Carrad and Burl flanked him, wearing expressions of irritation and discomfiture. Despite my longing, I dared not take my eyes off them. "Go ahead, bastard, look behind you. I shan't attack you. It would be a shame to spring such a trap as this on one such as you, and have you die before you appreciated the fullness of your failure. Go on. Look behind you." I turned my whole body slowly, to allow me to glance back with a mere shifting of my eyes. Gone. It was all gone. No royal sitting room, no curtained bed or carafe of wine, nothing. A plain, simple room. Probably for several ladies' maids to share, six liveried guards stood silent but attentive. All had drawn swords. My companions seem to feel that a drenching of fear will ferret out any man, but they, of course, have not experienced your strength of will as completely as I have. I do hope you appreciate the finesse I used in simply assuring you that you were seeing exactly what you most wished to see. He gave a glance each to Carrad and Burl. He has walls the like of which you have never experienced. But a wall that will not yield to a battering ram can still be breached by the gentle twining of ivy. He swung his attention back to me. You would have been a worthy opponent, save that in your conceit you always underestimated me. I still had not said a word. I stared at them all, letting the hatred that filled me strengthen my skill walls. All three had changed since I had last seen them. Burl, once a well-muscled carpenter, showed the effects of a good appetite and lack of exercise. Carrad's attire outshone the man within it. Ribbons and charms festooned his garments like blossoms on a springtime apple tree. But Will, seated between them in his chair, showed the greatest change of all.
He was dressed entirely in dark blue, in garments whose precise tailoring made them seem richer than Carrad's costume. A single chain of silver. A single ring on his hand, silver earrings. These were his only ornaments. Of his dark eyes, once so terrifyingly piercing, only one remained. The other was sunken deep in its socket, showing cloudy in the depths, like a dead fish in a dirty pool. He smiled at me as he saw me looking at it. He gestured at his eye. A memento of our last encounter. Whatever it was that you threw into my face.
A pity, I said, quite sincerely. I had meant those poisons to kill Regal, not half-blind you.
Will sighed lackadaisically.
Another admission of treason, as if we needed one.
Ah, well. We shall be more thorough this time. First, of course, we will spend a bit of time ferreting out just how you escaped death. A bit of time for that, and however much longer King Regal finds you amusing, he will have no need for either haste or discretion.
This time?
He gave a minuscule nod to the guards behind me. I smiled at him as I set the poisoned blade of my own knife to my left arm. I clenched my teeth against the pain as I dragged it down the length of my arm, not deeply, but enough to open my skin and let the poison from the blade into my blood. Will leaped to his feet in shock while Carrad and Burl looked horrified and disgusted. I passed my knife to my left hand, drew my sword with my right. "I'm dying now," I told them, smiling. "Probably very soon. I've no time to waste and nothing to lose." But he had been correct. I had always underestimated him. Somehow I found myself facing not the coterie members, but six guards with drawn blades. Killing myself was one thing, but being hacked to death while those I desired vengeance on watched was another. I spun about and felt a wave of dizziness as I did so, as if the room moved, rather than I myself. I lifted my eyes to find the swordsman still confronting me. I turned again and again, experienced a sensation of swinging. The thin line of blood along my arm had begun to burn. My chance to do anything about Will and Burl and Carrad was leaking away as the poison seeped through my blood. The guards were advancing on me, unhurriedly, fanning out in a half-circle and driving me before them as if I were an errant sheep. I backed up, glanced over my shoulder, and caught the most fleeting glimpse of the coterie members. Will stood, a step or so in front of the others, an annoyed look on his face. I had come here in the hope of killing Regal. I had barely succeeded in annoying his henchmen with my suicide.
Suicide?
Somewhere deep within me, Verity was horror-struck. Better than torture. Less than a whisper of skill on that thought, but I swear I felt Will go groping after it.
"Boy, stop this insanity! Get out of there! Come to me!"
"I cannot. It's too late. There's no escape. Let go of me. You only reveal yourself to them."
"Reveal myself?"
Verity's skill boomed suddenly in my mind, like thunder on a summer night, like storm waves shaking a shale cliff. I had seen him do this before. Angered, he would expend all of his skill strength in one effort, with no thought to what might befall him afterward. I felt Will hesitate, then plunge into that skilling, reaching after Verity, and trying to leech on to him.
"Study this revelation, you nest of adders!"
My king let forth his wrath. Verity's skilling was a blast of strength I had never encountered anywhere. It was not directed at me, but still I went to my knees. I heard Carrad and Burl cry out, guttural cries of terror. For a moment, my head and perceptions cleared, and I saw the room as it had always been, with the guardsmen arrayed between me and the coterie. Will was stretched senseless on the floor. Perhaps I alone felt the great surge of strength it cost Verity to save me. The guards were staggering, wilting like candles in the sun. I spun, saw the door at my back as it opened to admit more guards. 3 strides would carry me to the window.
"Come to me!"
There was no choice left for me in that command. It was impregnated with the skill it rode on, and it burned into my brain, becoming one with my breathing and the beating of my heart. I had to go to Verity. It was a cry both of command and now, of need. My king had sacrificed his reserves to save me. There were heavy curtains over the window and thick, whorled glass behind them. Neither stopped me as I launched myself out into the air beyond, hoping there would at least be bushes below me to break some of my fall. Instead, I slammed to the earth amid the shards of glass a fraction of a moment later. I had leaped, expecting to fall at least 1 story from a ground-floor window. For a split second I appreciated the completeness of how Will had deceived me. Then I staggered to my feet, still clutching my knife and my sword, and ran. The grounds were not well lit outside the servant's wing. I blessed the darkness and fled. Behind me I heard cries, and then Burl shouting orders. They'd be on my trail in moments. I'd not escape here on foot. I veered off to the more solid darkness of the stables. The departure of the ball's guests had stirred the stable to activity. Most of the hands on duty were probably around in front of the mansion, holding horses. The doors of the stable were opened wide to the soft night air, and lanterns were lit within it. I charged in, very nearly bowling over a stable hand. She could not have been more than 10, a skinny, freckled girl. And she staggered back, then shrieked at the sight of my drawn weapons. "I'm just taking a horse," I told her reassuringly. "I won't hurt you." She was backing away as I sheathed my sword, and then my knife. She spun suddenly.
"Hans! Hans!"
She raced off, shrieking his name. I had no time to give any thought to it. 3 stalls down from me, I saw Regal's own black regarding me curiously over his manger. I approached him calmly, reached to rub his nose and recall myself to him. Perhaps it had been 8 months since he'd smelled me, but I'd known him since he was foaled. He nibbled at my collar, his whiskers tickling my neck. "Come on, Arrow. We're going for some night exercise. Just like old times, huh, fellow?" I eased his stall open, took his halter, and walked him out. I didn't know where the girl had gone, but I could no longer hear her. Arrow was tall and not accustomed to being ridden bareback. He crow-hopped a bit as I scrabbled up onto his sleek back. Even in the midst of all this danger, I felt a keen pleasure at being on horseback again. I gripped his mane, kneed him forward. He took 3 steps, then halted at the man blocking his way. I looked down at Hans's incredulous face. I had to grin at his shocked expression. "Just me, Hans. Got to borrow a horse or they'll kill me. Again." I think perhaps I expected him to laugh and wave me through. Instead, he just stared up at me, going whiter and whiter, until I thought he'd faint. "It's me, Fitz. I'm not dead. Let me out, Hans." He stepped back. "Sweet Ida," he exclaimed, and I thought surely he would throw back his head and laugh. Instead, he hissed, "Beast magic." Then he spun and fled off into the night, bawling, "Guards! Guards!" I lost perhaps 2 seconds gawking after him. I felt a wrench inside me, such as I had not felt since Molly had left me. The years of friendship, the long day-in, day-out routine of stable work together, all washed away in a moment of his superstitious terror. It was unfair, but I felt sickened by his betrayal. Coldness welled up in me, but I set heels to Arrow and plunged out into darkness. He trusted me, did that good horse, so well trained by Burrich. I took him away from the torch-lit carriage path and the cleared walkways, fleeing through flower beds and plantings, before racing out past a huddle of guards at one of the tradesfolk's gates.
They had been watching up the path, but Arrow and I came thundering across the turf and were out the gate before they knew what we were about. They'd wear stripes for that tomorrow, if I knew Regal at all. Beyond the gate, we once more cut across the gardens. Behind us, I could hear shouts of pursuit. Arrow answered my knees and weight very well for a horse that was used to a rein. I convinced him to push through a hedge and out onto a side road. We left the King's Gardens behind us and kept our gallop up through the better section of town, over cobbled streets where torches still burned. But soon we left the fine houses behind as well. We thundered along past inns still lit for travellers, past shops dark and shuttered for the night, Arrow's hooves thudding on the clay roads. As late as it was, there was little movement on the streets. We raced through them, as unchecked as the wind. I let him slow as we reached the commoner section of town. Here, street torches were more widely spaced, and some had already burned out for the night. Still, Arrow sensed my urgency and kept up a respectable pace. Once I heard another horse, ridden hard, and for a moment, I thought the pursuit had found us. Then a messenger passed us by, heading the opposite direction, without even checking his horse's pace. I rode on and on, always fearing to hear horses behind us, waiting for the sounds of horns. Just when I began to think we had eluded pursuit, I discovered that Tradeford held one more horror for me. I entered what had once been the great circle market of Tradeford. In the earliest days of the city, it had been the heart of it, a wonderful, great open market where a man might stroll and find goods from every corner of the known world on display. How it had degenerated from that to Regal's King's Circle, I have never exactly been able to discover. I only knew that as I rode through the great open circle of the market, Arrow snorted at the smell of old blood on the cobbles under his hooves. The old gallows and the whipping posts were still there, elevated now for the benefit of the crowd, along with other mechanical devices whose uses I had no wish to understand. No doubt those in the new King's Circle would be even more imaginatively cruel. I kneed Arrow and passed them all with a chill shudder and a prayer to Ida that I be preserved from them. Then a twist of feeling writhed through the air, wrapped itself around my thoughts and bent them. For a heart-thudding moment, I thought that Will reached after me with the skill and sought to drive me mad. But my skill walls were as stout as I knew how to raise, and I doubt that Will or anyone else would be soon able to skill after Verity's blast. No. This was worse. This came from a deeper, more primal source, as insidious as clear water that was poisoned. It flowed into me, hatred and pain and stifling claustrophobia, and hunger, all rolled into one dreadful longing for freedom and revenge. It reawakened everything I had ever felt in Regal's dungeons. It came from the cages. A great stench came from the row of them at the edges of the circle, a stench of infected wounds and urine and rotted meat. Yet even that affront to my nose was not as great as the press of hell-tinged wit that emanated from them. They held insane beasts, the creatures kept to savage the human criminals and forged ones that Regal threw to them. There was a bear, heavily muzzled despite the bars he paced behind. There were two great cats of a kind I had never seen, in agony from the broken fangs and torn claws they had wasted on their bars, and yet stubbornly battling their prison still. There was an immense black bull with a great sweep of horns. This last animal's flesh was studded with ribboned darts sunken into wounds that festered and oozed pus down his hide. Their misery dinned at me, clamoring for relief, yet I did not need to stop to see the heavy chains and locks that secured each cage. Had I had a pick, I might have tried to cheat the locks. Had I had meat or grain, I might have freed them with poison. But I had neither of those things, and even less a time,
so I rode past them until the wave of their madness and agony crested over and drenched me. I pulled in on the reins. I could not leave them behind, but come to me. The command surged through me, skill graven. It was not endurable to disobey it. I set my heels to jittering arrow and left them behind, tallying up to Regal's account yet another debt that some day I would settle. True light found us finally on the outskirts of town. I had never imagined that Tradeford was so large. We came to a slow stream feeding into the river. I pulled Arrow in, then dismounted, and led him to the waterside. I let him drink a bit, then walked him for a while, then let him drink some more. The whole time my mind seethed with a thousand thoughts. They were probably searching the roads that led south, expecting me to head back to Buck. I had a good lead on them now, as long as I kept moving. I had a good chance of escape. I recalled my cleverly stashed bundle that would never be reclaimed. My winter clothes, my blanket, my cloak, all lost to me. I wondered suddenly if Regal would blame Hans for my stealing the horse. I kept recalling the look in Hans's eyes before he fled me. I found myself being glad I had not yielded to the temptation to track Molly down. It was hard enough to see that horror and disgust in the face of a friend. I never wanted to see it in her eyes. I recalled again the dumb agony of the beasts that my wit made me witness. Such thoughts were pushed aside by my frustration that my attempt on Regal had been thwarted, and the wondering if they would detect the poisons I had used on his clothes, or if I might yet succeed at killing him. Overall, thundering through me, was Verity's command. "Come to me," he had said, and I could not quite stop hearing those words. A small part of my mind was obsessed with them, nagged me, even now, not to waste my time in thinking or drinking, but merely to get back on the horse and go to Verity, that he needed me, commanded me. Yet stoop to drink I did, and it was while I was on my knees at the water's edge that I noticed I wasn't dead. I wet the sleeve of the yellow shirt in the stream, then gently peeled the blood-caked fabric loose. The cut I had inflicted on myself was shallow, not much more than a long slice up my arm. It was sore and angry to look at, but it did not appear poisoned. I recalled belatedly that I had used my knife to kill twice that night and wiped it off at least once. There had probably been no more than a trace of poison left on it when I cut myself. Like a morning dawning, hope suddenly gleamed for me. They'd be looking for a body by the road, or searching for a poisoned man hiding somewhere in the city, too ill by now to bestride a horse. The whole coterie had watched me poison myself, and must have sensed my complete belief in my imminent death. Could they convince Regal I was dying? I wouldn't trust to that, but I could hope for it. I remounted and pushed swiftly on. We passed farmsteads, grain fields, and orchards. We passed farmers on carts, too, taking their crops to town. I rode, clutching my arm to my chest, staring straight ahead. It would only be a matter